The Central Pacific Hurricane Center, which has been tracking Hurricane Lane, issued the update at the top of the hour. Joining us now is HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, to fill us in.
Yes, and Catherine, not a lot of changes. Derek reflected a lot of that in terms of the information. The warnings, the watches stay as they have been. Some of the interesting information about this goes to the outlook, which is which shifts and which, again, in terms of adjusting as the day goes on, it is expected to weaken as the day goes on, a steady weakening trend forecast to begin today. But again, they stress Lane expected to remain a dangerous hurricane as it approaches the islands. And again, on the general track, it's moving west-northwest about 8 miles an hour right now. It's about a little less than 300 miles, about 285 miles south of Kailua Kona on the Big Island, and takes a little more than 400 miles from Honolulu. Two interesting points to make on this. They talk about under the discussion section about hazards affecting Lane. Rain comes first, and the rain bands come first that are not actually part of the technical hurricane
the
itself.
System, right.
Mm-hmm. But that's that system. And those rain bands from Hurricane Lane moving ashore on Puna and Kau now. And those are that's going to be growing as the day goes on. But again, in terms of approaching later tonight, really in terms of a lot of these winds. By the way, for folks at home, if you're tracking this, we talk a lot about sourcing. You know, the important source on this is the Central Pacific Hurricane Center. You can use your favorite search engine to track them down. But they have these updates throughout the day. As you said, one just at 11. They have a an intermediate one coming out at 2 in the afternoon, and then 5 o'clock this afternoon they'll have more complete advisory on that. But one other highlight, this is, again, nothing new, but it's important to bear in mind as you hear these different forecasts that it's not just where the center of the hurricane is. Hurricane force winds extend outward to about 40 miles from the center. Hurricane force winds. Tropical storm force winds extend out to 140 miles beyond the beyond the center. So again, when you're hearing words about tracking where the center of a hurricane is, the impact goes much broader than that. And just in terms of, again, for those keeping score at home, in terms of what does that mean, Category 4, wind speeds 130 to 156 miles an hour. And now you talk about a weakening trend. Okay, so you take that down to Category 3, that's still 111 to 129 miles an hour at sustained winds, and then it drops further further from that. Tropical storm winds, anything above 39 miles an hour up until about 73 miles an hour, those are something that are tracked on the leading edge of this. So, again, we'll be hearing from the governor this afternoon. We'll be hearing from the mayor here on Oahu this afternoon. So, again, we'll have updates as they become available, but it's approaching, it's moving slowly.
Right, and we've been hearing about how folks are running out to the stores to get their supplies, their batteries, the water. I know one gas station I checked on last night because I wanted to gas up. Mm. They were out of gas. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, folks just need to prepare, get ready, just in case something happens. The power goes out and you can't, get to the places that are powered by electricity. The pumps at the gas station, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But again, prepare for the rain and the wind, batten down the hatches, anything you can tie down or move so they don't become flying projectiles. You got to do that now.
All very true.
Right, and prepare for the rain.
Yes,
flood.
Exactly. One interesting point, FEMA, by the way, Federal Emergency Management Agency, had a news conference. They're emphasizing also local control on this in terms of it's down to the counties. And you hear that from the governor yesterday, I'm sure today as well, because it's very localized. So
right.
It's a county guidance.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
You bet.
Now, the Hawaiian Islands remain vulnerable as a Category 4 Hurricane Lane passes south of the Hawaii Islands. You can track the system online. Important to track with different impacts to different islands. got a junk car you want to get rid of? Well, did you know the city has a program to tow it for free? The Department of Customer Services says a recent survey found that most people aren't aware it exists. The problem of abandoned and derelict vehicles varies from island to island. Here on Oahu, the city secured two lots this summer to remove the junk cars off its city golf courses where the vehicles were being stored temporarily. We talked with Deputy Director Randy Leong about the progress being made to deal with the cars left behind by military personnel and how it's chipping away at the problem overall.
In this particular lot, we have about 125 abandoned service members' vehicles that we picked up. In other words, cars owned by members of the military. We temporarily stored these military-owned vehicles at our West Lock and Eva Village golf course for a year. And that was just a temporary measure while we were able to work out an agreement with the state. And in this particular lot here, we were able to work out an agreement with the state. It's a State Department of Transportation Harbors Division. We also have a lot in Pearl City, where we also worked with the State Department of Transportation Highways Division. And in that particular lot, we are able to store approximately 280 abandoned vehicles.
What else do we need to do in order to comply with the new state law? I guess that you've got to move abandoned or derelict cars, you know, off the streets within 10 days.
Yeah, so regarding that law, which took effect on July 1, that law essentially states that the car needs to be removed within 10 days. That time clock, Catherine, actually starts when our motor vehicle control inspector deems it as an abandoned vehicle. So the time clock doesn't start when the call comes in or when we receive the call. It actually starts out when our inspector goes out, does his or her investigation, and deems it as an abandoned vehicle.
And that requires what? Ticketing it, marking the car?
Right, absolutely. It requires the inspector to go out. They mark the cars, they chalk the tires, and come back within a day or two and see if it's been moved. If it hasn't been moved, then a citation can be put on, and then we'll call for call for a work order with our tow contractor, and at that point, it's deemed as an abandoned vehicle for pickup.
Okay, so at this point, we're able to comply with that new rule.
Yes, we are. We are. We've worked with our towing contractor to aggressively put them on a plan, and that plan actually, for our intents and purposes, is for them to pick up the car within 3 days. So it's, the 10-day time frame provides us with a little bit of cushion for the contractor to pick it up, but our expectation for them does remain within 3 days. We've actively worked with the military to encourage them to speak to the member of the military after they leave or upon their discharge or release from the state. And I think that it's part of their outboarding process is what they call it, part of their checklist of what they need to do to make sure that they've taken care of all their business, including their car, once they leave the island.
So right, because it's become a real headache for the city when that military service member is not here.
It has become a burden for us, Catherine. And on our part, what we've done last year, it's been 1 year since we've redesigned our new form that the military uses to register their vehicle. So that form that the service member comes in to register their car has a lot of vital information that we use to track down the person, the service member.
And that's half the battle.
And that is half the battle, whether it's personal identifying information. I've even asked for their email address. So we've used those information on the new form to actually get a hold of the military member and have them sign the waiver. If that's been unsuccessful, then I go directly to the commander. So far, since July 1, we've picked up about 500 abandoned vehicles on the island. Okay.
It's July 1st of this year?
July 1st.
Wow.
So if you carry that out to an annual number, that's upwards of 3,500 to nearly 4,000 cars that we're picking up annually. It's a lot of cars. A lot of cars that people have abandoned. They don't want to take ownership of it, and it's left with the city. So we encourage the folks out there, the general public out there, if they have a vehicle that they don't want and don't want to take the time to sell it or just want to get rid of it, to properly junk that vehicle. We have a junking form on our website, and they take it down to the Satellite City Hall, bring down their plates and their registration and all their papers, and the city will pick it up for free, provided that it's out in front of their house, and we'll pick it up. Just don't go out there
and dump it.
Properly junk the car, turn in all the paperwork at the Satellite City Hall, and just put it out in the front of your house.
And the city will tow it for free.
The city will tow it for free. Yes. We all need to work together. It's a community effort. It's everyone taking ownership of the problem and being responsible for their actions. Okay. On the reporting side, Catherine, mm-hmm. if somebody has a report of an abandoned vehicle in their neighborhood, that number to call is 768-2530. And our clerks will pick up the phone, take down all the information. What I do ask the general public, though, is that when they call this number, to provide as much information as possible related to the car, the color of the vehicle, the license plate, the make and model, if they can distinguish it, and the exact location, such as cross streets. It makes it easier for our inspectors to go down there and investigate that particular vehicle.
You can also report it on the 311 City app as well. That was Randy Leong, the Deputy Director of the City's Office of Customer Services, talking about overcoming the hurdles for clearing junk cars off of city streets. And this morning on the Big Island, the County Council takes up a bill to clarify what it can do to rid neighborhoods of the eyesores and safety hazards of the abandoned and derelict cars. Councilmember Eileen O'Hara, who introduced the measure, explains the predicament that Hawaii Island is in. Many junk cars are being dumped in remote areas before property owners even realize their lots have become illegal storage areas. The large expanse of the island also makes the towing of junk cars a challenge.
Our program does not apply to private roads. I don't know if you know how the AV program works by state law. It is applied to public roadways. And what we've done here over the many years is operate our abandoned vehicle program such that we considered that director policy alone, meaning director of the Department of Environmental Management, was sufficient to extend the program to hauling abandoned vehicles off of private roads. And that decision came down in 2003. I happened to be in the Department of Environmental Management time as the county's recycling coordinator, and our director looked at that, and Corporation Counsel, the attorneys for the county, opined that we could extend it to private roads, and that was a legitimate application of the abandoned vehicle program. We did at that time also raise the fee, which is charged on everyone's registration of vehicle, to allow sufficient funding for the scrap metal program, which includes the abandoned vehicle program. So at that point, 0203, we established sufficient funding to do the program and extended it to operate on private roads. And here in the Kona District in particular, because of the large substandard subdivisions with private roads, more than 50% of the roads in this entire district, which is the size of Oahu, are private, and we were seeing some of the worst problems occur on these remote private roads.
So
that operated that way for 15 years up until March 1 of this year, and because there were changes made to this state law that establishes how this program operates, how the abandoned vehicle program operates, those changes were to require a shorter time from the point where the car is identified as abandoned to where it's taken off of the side of the road. That period of time now has to be no more than 10 days. So when state law was changed, and in consideration of the passage of that change, our current corporation counsel, different attorneys than were here in 03, opined that the program needed to be codified to allow it to extend to private roads. So we received a different legal opinion this time, and that was March 1 of this year. And as of that date, the County of Hawaii has ceased to remove abandoned vehicles from private roads.
I see.
So we
so
now
then,
have a whole bunch.
So what would your bill do?
The bill will change county code such that we can apply the abandoned vehicle program to private roads open to the public. It's going to alleviate a backlog that has developed since March 1. I've been up into some of the upper Puna subdivisions for their private roads recently and saw abandoned vehicles literally blocking roadways. So that prevents emergency vehicles from accessing the community when they need to. Well, hopefully it'll make our community safer by extending this AB bill to private roads.
Does anyone have a handle on how big this problem is? I mean, because if the cars have just been stacking up for the last 6 months.
I don't know that we have a handle on how much additional disposal is going to be required to get us back to where we were as of March 1. I don't think anybody's done that analysis. One thing that the department is also looking at, Department of Environmental Management, is they have an abandoned vehicle coordinator, and they would like to extend the duties of that position to alleviate the need for the police to come on site. I think they have to come on site twice in order to properly identify the AB. And if we can provide those duties in the position of the abandoned vehicle coordinator, it might help to streamline the program so that we can meet the new state law requirement of 10 days. Because the program has not been functioning with that level of efficiency through the many years. In some cases, I've seen it take as long as 3 weeks, 4 weeks from the point where the vehicle is called in as an abandoned vehicle to the point where it's removed from the road.
Yeah, that's a long time.
And it is a long time, and people get frustrated with that. The other aspect in which I included an amendment to my bill is that while it may seem apparent to all of us that when you're driving down the road and you see an abandoned vehicle, that it's an abandoned vehicle because it's been sitting on the side of the road for over a day, and then the tires start to be taken off, and pretty soon the hood's gone, and, you know, other pieces of the car start going missing. It may be apparent to us that it's an abandoned vehicle, but the police do not take action on it until someone calls it in as an abandoned vehicle.
Right, it's complaint-driven.
It's complaint-driven, exactly. So the police don't stop and say, oh, this looks like an abandoned vehicle. I'm going to investigate. No, it's complaint-driven. And the public doesn't realize that because they're driving by and going, obviously, this is an abandoned vehicle. Why aren't they doing something? So I've in my bill, I included a public outreach component so that the Department of Environmental Management will be required to develop a educational program for the public to let them know that this is a complaint-driven activity. Here's the number that you call, and make sure that you, track your calls to the police department or wherever they'll be calling to ensure that the vehicle is removed in a timely manner. In this period of time where we're going to be doing catch-up for the next few months once this bill gets finalized, it'll be interesting to see if our inventory area is sufficient to hold all the vehicles that might be brought in. We just need to make our program more efficient so that we can meet the 10-day requirement for perhaps have regional contracts for the tow companies that the county will use to remove the vehicles so that we can not only reduce the cost but also reduce time. And the other was they're looking into kind of deputizing, I guess is the proper word, the abandoned vehicle coordinator so that the police don't have so much direct involvement.
That was Councilmember Eileen O'Hara talking about a bill the county takes up today to try and tackle its problem with abandoned vehicles. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your quiz. We got to thinking about the history of Greeks in Hawaii in light of the upcoming Greek festival here in Honolulu this weekend. Now, the Greeks were in the islands as early as Captain Vancouver's expedition here and taking up residence as whalers and traders as early as the 1830s. By the 1880s, a number of Greek-owned businesses had become well-established, and they put local Greeks in conflict with the missionary community. One Greek businessman whose name we're looking for entered into a partnership with Campbell, Marshall & Company, a venture that went sour. Now, lawsuits and countersuits between the principals put this man and the whole Greek community at odds with the conservative missionaries. Now, the businessman became an ardent opponent of the overthrow of the monarchy and later died in a mainland asylum under mysterious circumstances. This morning, we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941 3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Shared working spaces. It's a trend that's forcing companies to rethink their business plan. HPR's Noe Tanigawa is here to tell us more. So, Noe, this concept was fueled by startups, right?
Well, startups are certainly using this idea. Actually, it's something that if you talk to the person who kind of originally did the first co-working space in Hawaii, Raichung Fujihira, he says it's actually based on the fact that we can work off the cloud now.
Oh, okay.
That frees us from one particular physical space. I mean, do you really know what co-working is? I mean, does it?
I had to go do an interview somewhere downtown, yeah. And there were like three different companies operating in one little space, and they had a shared like conference room, that kind
of
thing.
Right. So that's one model of co-working, and there are other ways where people who are starting up a business or people who just plan to be all by themselves forever have a space to work. It's kind of obvious that something like this is needed. You work in the library and you outgrow that. You can only stand the blender in the coffee place for so long. And then, you know, adults need a place to work. And they're coming up with some terrific ideas here. Want to take a tour of a really cool workspace
in
Kaka'ako? Okay, look, we're going to tour Impact Hub Honolulu. Ann Weber is the director of community there. And community is a big thing at these co-working spaces. It's the atmosphere you create and the programs that you institute for your members. It's kind of like a gym, actually. You do a monthly membership or yearly membership, and you go as much as you want, okay? Ann Weber is bullish about co-working spaces and what they can do for us here in Honolulu. Here we go.
We have a couple phone booths as well. But again, the space isn't a library, so you can take calls. And those are actually some members built those for us as well. So we're always trying to figure out like creative ways to partner. And the kitchen, it's totally self-serve. On Wednesdays, we all have lunch together here, kombucha and nitro coffee on tap. And then members, of course, get coffee and tea, and we have beer and wine as well. Also surfboard racks, because we're so close to the beach, and a little nap area there. This office is actually our wellness hub. So we have a psychiatrist, a clinical herbalist, and an acupuncturist working out of that office. And then, of course, your standard business amenities, your printers, your copy machines. This one's our small moving room.
I mean, so you've got to picture this, right, Catherine, right? You're in a giant space that's divided basically in two. On one side, all these tables, like picnic tables that people work at individually or in groups. The other side, another big space in the middle, a really comfy, cozy kitchen, all of these single office spaces you can rent if that's the way you want to do it. There are meeting rooms. And all the walls, like, move on rollers and stuff so they can be reconfigured to any kind of space.
I love the naps and snacks part, though.
I know. It's really super. What's great is that every space has its different personality right now. I mean, I thought Box Jelly, well, now it's Box Jelly and the company. They've just taken on another partner. This was the very first co-working space that opened in Honolulu back in 2010, 2011.
I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's that there on Kamani Street in Kaka'ako. Rachung Fujihira started it with a partner of his. What they really wanted to do was create, their idea was, look, we can create a airport lounge outside an airport. Because that's basically what you want to do, right? You want to work, you want to pass the time, and you want to have some company while you're doing it. And nobody knew what co-working was at that time. That's only 7 years ago. And now, Maui, Kauai, Biga, all these wonderful places have co-working spaces as well. And what's so cute is that at this perfect moment in history in Hawaii, each one of those co-working spaces has its own unique environment. That could change when the big boxes come in.
Oh man, WeWork has changed the game, right? So WeWork is the biggest co-working space right now. Uh-huh. I think they have, I want to say 700 spaces maybe in the world, and they're just kind of like normalizing the model. It's good in the fact that more people understand what we do. You know, certain types of offices, you really want to have an office, but you know, you even see companies like Microsoft, SoftBank, Dropbox. A lot of these companies are now renting from co-working spaces and somewhat outsourcing a lot of things, including culture, to the co-working space. You just basically buy into a space that has a culture for you, right?
Get that, Catherine? Mm-hmm. So that is you know how much time and energy places use creating the culture for their office and their people? They just buy time at these co-working spaces, and you and I could go meet for coffee there, discuss some things, come back to the office. You know, you can hold meetings there. It's just an alternative space. And now is the perfect moment because we have so many diverse spaces before the big boxes do come into this town. I mean, last Friday, I was over at Kavaivai. It's the Vaivai Collective. They're in their circular building at Varsity. It's on the ground floor where the Bank of Hawaii used to be. Mm-hmm. And that is a perfectly unique co-working space. They have worked a deal where the monthly rental basic membership that you pay is a lot lower than some spaces. And last Friday, they had an amazing group of musicians perform in the nighttime. I'm not even going to tell you who was there because it was so fantastic.
Wow. I want to go.
Yeah, I know. And Co-Work is there in Kaka'ako as well. I saw a musical tour of the Muslim diaspora there just a couple of months ago. I mean, the things that happen in these places weren't happening before in Honolulu and maybe on the neighbor islands too. So it's a great thing to look for.
So it's not just work, but kind of work and play?
It's turning into a lifestyle thing. They're making a nice place out of it. They're making an impact with the resources they have. And Rachung says, Hawaii can really grasp onto this. We got the best people now who can leverage technologies to draw in resources from any place in the globe. And he says co-working is going to be part of that for us.
I wonder if Hawaii Public Radio can entertain an idea. Let's chew on this one.
Let's do that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Noe. That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa talking about incubator spaces taking hold across the state.
HPR supporters have watched Danny Carvalho grow from teenage slack key prodigy to band leader, producer, and working musician. He has recently teamed with singer-songwriter and hula dancer Nani Edgar to form Kailua Moon. Catch them and their fresh sound in the Atherton on Saturday the 25th. Call HPR during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
On today's Reality Check, our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat continue our look at Hurricane Lane. Editor John Hill is on the line. Morning.
Morning. Happy to be here.
So tell us about this cone of uncertainty. What have you been able to find out?
Well, the cone of uncertainty that we all see on the news and on websites is based on the five-year error experience of previous hurricanes. So they look back 5 years and say, well, how far off did they go from where we thought they would go? And they use that to create this cone that we all are seeing and worrying about now.
And I know in your story that you talked about going up and actually getting inside the hurricane eye.
Yeah, I didn't do that, but I interviewed a meteorologist who did do that, and apparently it's a spectacular sight. There's something called a sort of a stadium effect where you fly through the eye wall into the eye of the hurricane, and you look around you, and there's I've seen pictures of it. There's just huge towers of clouds all around you, and the sun is shining down through blue sky above you.
Now, yeah, I've been up in one of those flights, and it is crazy. It's just unbelievable, really.
I'm jealous of you. I'd like to do that myself, although he did say that it was pretty turbulent. I don't know if yours was as well. They had to ground that plane the next morning to make sure it was still fit to fly for the next mission.
Now, I know my experience has been with typhoons, and they can sometimes be fickle. So what can you tell us about Lane?
Lane is fickle, and it's harder to predict than Hector, which came through 2 weeks ago, was just sort of on a straight line due west. And there, none of the forecasts ever said that it was going to pivot or turn. And now we have this one, Lane, that is going to make a turn and is already making a turn like that. And that's what makes the models, that's challenging for the models they use. They use these very sophisticated dynamic models that get all this data put into them, and then they just have a hard time predicting exactly when the turn will occur. And, of course, that's a crucial piece of information.
Right. I mean, because you need that information to let people know, hey, it's going to zig, not zag, and it can tell you, you know, what's going to be in harm's way.
Exactly.
Now, what about the whole climate change thing? I mean, because we're seeing some pretty radical stuff happen elsewhere across the world. Do we know what kind of effect this might have on Hurricane Lane?
Yeah, I did talk to one meteorologist yesterday who mentioned that this summer has been unusual. What usually happens in Hawaii is that there's a high-pressure subtropical ridge to our north, and that high pressure acts sort of like a wall. So it prevents hurricanes from coming too far north into our neighborhood. But this summer, he said, has been unusual. And there have been weather systems that have come from the northern hemisphere, the northern latitudes north of us, and kind of broken down the wall on more than one occasion. And he thought that might have something to do with the masses of hot air in the northern latitudes this summer. We've all heard about the heat waves in various places, and that can create, it can sort of block the normal pattern of airflow and cause systems to to wander down our way, and that can break down the
wall.
Well,
I guess we'll see what happens if this hurricane does weaken like they expect it to do later today. But we'll check back with you to see how we fared over this this hurricane. We'll see what happens through the weekend.
Yeah, we'll all be interested in that.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot, John.
Take care.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat editor John Hill. To read more about the preparations for Hurricane Lane, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, this is Will Shorts, Puzzle Master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a Greek businessman in the late 19th century Hawaii who was a supporter of the monarchy and sought its return to power. He was part of a group of local Greeks who remained loyal to the monarchy in the wake of the overthrow and found themselves at odds with the missionary elite that engineered it. Those communities had long been in conflict due to business rivalries and competition in the pineapple and the export industries. The businessman that we're thinking of this morning was one of the most committed advocates of the restoration of the monarchy. He apparently suffered from mental illness in his later years and was committed to the Andrews Asylum for the Insane in California in 1896, where he died under mysterious circumstances a year later. His family believed he'd been murdered for his political views. His death caused a stir back home in Hawaii, as Peter Camarinos had been a prominent member of a close-knit Greek immigrant community. And nobody got that one. We stumped you today. But that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The 11th Annual Hawaii Adaptive Surfing Championships wraps up today in Waikiki. Now, there are plenty of surf competitions across Hawaii, but this one is unique among them. The big difference, many of the competitors arrive at the beach in a wheelchair. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty went to Waikiki Beach and brings us this report.
Hawaii is known around the world as the birthplace of surfing. In the island's territorial days, Duke Kahanamoku introduced the Western world to the sport of wave riding at Queen's Surf Break in Waikiki. Today, under the watchful gaze of the Duke statue, Queens is once again the site of a milestone event in the world of surfing. For the past 11 years, Waikiki's most famous wave has been home to the Hawaii Adaptive Surfing Championship. It was the first surfing competition anywhere in the world specifically for athletes with a physical disability. One of those competitors is Spike Kane, a lifelong surfer from Liverpool, England. On land, he now uses a wheelchair, but that hasn't kept him out of the water.
I started surfing in a little beach called Rosanaga on the island of Anglesey in Wales, in the northwest corner of Wales. I am a spinal cord injury complete at the T1 level. So my spinal cord was completely severed. It's really high, so it affects my arms a bit. And from my armpits down, I have absolutely zero function. But that's been an evolution. I was injured 13 years ago, and I just went, I already knew about adaptive surfing before I was injured. I immediately started doing research to get back in the ocean, which I did right away. I just went out with my mates. But it took me a few years. As soon as I could afford it, I jumped on a plane and flew to Hawaii and went for a day at the beach.
The group that Spike came to meet was called Access Surf. The Hawaii-based organization was pioneering the field of adaptive surfing and ocean therapy. Access Surf organizes the annual adaptive surf contest in Waikiki, but also sponsors monthly non-competitive beach days. According to Spike Kane, the benefits are not just for the participants.
The baseline of their whole operation is therapeutic. You know, they gather people regularly, both able-bodied and disabled, and the therapy is equal in that. Like, if you're helping somebody in the water, like fully able-bodied, say you've got a 9-to-5 job, and over a weekend you know you're going to go and help out at this event, you're going to come away from it totally charged, totally, like, renewed, and you'll have a sense of purpose that you may not have had before. And it's so important that that's available within communities everywhere. And what Access Surf is doing is they're bringing that global community together. There's a lot of things going on in Europe, South Africa, Australia, Brazil, Chile, all over the world right now because people have been exposed to Access Surf. So they are, like, to me, that is ground zero for the movement.
As competitive events like this one begin to organize around the world, some more mundane questions begin to arise. What equipment will be allowed? How will athletes with different degrees of physical function be grouped? Ann Yoshida from Mililani is one of the people figuring all that out. Complications from a car crash put her in a wheelchair, but haven't slowed her down. She is a world champion in adaptive surfing and during the 2016 Paralympics became the first native Hawaiian woman to compete in the paracanoe. One of her projects out of the water has been to develop the adaptive surfing classification system.
What I did was broke it down into surf style. And surf style would be like stand, kneel, sit, which is a wave ski, and prone, and then prone assist. And all of those are subdivided into 1, 2, and 3, meaning 1 being the most, the least amount of function, and 3 being the most amount of function. And so you just see someone and they may choose to surf in the stand division, and then based on their functional ability we classify them into 1, 2, or 3. The goals with the classification system is, one, to even out the playing field of competition, but because there's such a diverse amount of people who have different conditions and disabilities that make their functions different, and it's endless, really. So one is to level the playing ground, and the other thing is to develop the minimum eligibility requirements so that someone who has much more function than you is not competing against someone who is not.
Not all of the competitors were surfers before their injury. Zach Topek is from Honolulu, but now lives in Costa Rica. This is his fourth time competing in the Hawaii Adaptive Surfing Championship.
My family being from Hawaii, I was always in the water. But since my injury, I never really had a chance to get back into the water. The sand is pretty difficult to get in and out through the sand. So as adaptive surfing is growing, there's more mats, there's more accessibility. So that wasn't really available 20 years ago when I was injured. But now the accessibility and the access is so easy. It's amazing. The chance to get into the water is amazing. Being mobile without a wheelchair, I think, is the highlight of all surfing. There's only a few instances where I don't need my chair, and surfing is one of them.
The woman behind this event is Kara Short. She's the executive director of Access Surf. In addition to the adaptive surf competition, the group also organizes monthly beach days for anyone with a disability.
Well, as you can imagine, it's pretty emotional, you know, for a lot of people. Many of our people who come, they may not have been in the ocean since their injury. Actually, I met a man just the other day. It had been 25 years since he'd been in the ocean. So it tends to be a lot of emotional feelings, excitement, thrilling, smiles. It's so much packed into one, and it's a real energy. And I think that's what's been such an appeal for our programs, is that feeling that comes from it. And it's not just the participant, but the volunteers working together, and, you know, everyone being part of it and sharing. Everyone sharing their passion for the ocean and being outdoors, just straight up being outside. You know, a lot of people will come to our day at the beach because it is an accessible day. The whole beach is accessible, or not the whole beach, but we have accessibility on the beach. And we'll sometimes just come and talk story, just to, you know, be with people and be with your ohana.
For the surfers at Queens today, competition can be its own form of therapy.
I think for those individuals that are natural competitors, natural athletes, or, you know, prior to their injury, or even post, some people actually came more after, you know, they were like, okay, this is my new life, where am I going to put my energy? But what I feel like, and they're whole, you know, it's like they've come back to themselves. Because what I hear a lot in stories is after an injury, a lot of people feel like something's been taken away, of course, when they're able to get back into surfing and then competing as they had once done, but not the same, of course. It's like it's completing themselves.
And although they now ride different equipment, today's competitors sound just like any other surfer after a good session.
Surfing is freedom. Surfing is freedom. You get a chance to connect with the water, connect with the universe, to connect with your spirit, your soul. It gives you the freedom to move about off land, out of your chair, to meet other great people. Surfing has a lot of different doors that you can open up and a lot of different avenues to really take you around the world. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Surfing is definitely an identifying thing that I do. So I am not just a competitive surfer, but I'm a lifetime surfer. Being able to have fun and enjoy being out of my comfort zone all the time and having that experience of humility, of grappling with the ocean.
Surfing, you know what it means to me? It's just like soul food. And it's what I just chow down on every opportunity I can get. It's spiritual, it's healing, and it's community. That's probably the most important thing of it all.
From the Hawaii Adaptive Surfing Championship in Waikiki, Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And to find the results of this year's contest or to learn how you can volunteer, head over to accesssurf.org. And recapping preparations for Hurricane Lane, if you're a visitor or a resident, here's what you need to know. As of 11 a.m., the center of Hurricane Lane was 295 miles south of Hilo and moving west-northwest at 8 miles per hour. High surf warnings are in effect for south-facing shores of all islands, and a flash flood watch is in effect for all islands until Friday evening. Now, if you're traveling over the next few days, the Department of Transportation says check with your airline before you go to the airport. As far as ports, as of last update, all ports across Hawaii are open but under warning status. Ports on Hawaii Island are conditioned Yankee, which is the highest warning level before closure, and port facilities in all other counties are set at condition X-ray. Under Coast Guard order, all ocean-going vessels and barges weighing 200 tons or more must obtain a permit to remain in port or make preparations to depart before the ports are closed to in- and outbound traffic. This is known as Condition Zulu. And as far as schools, all public schools and Hawaii State Department of Education offices on Maui and Hawaii Island are closed until further notice. Families of students in charter schools should contact their schools directly to learn about those closures, and all public libraries and support offices on Hawaii Island, Maui, Lanai, and Molokai are closed today. All library programs statewide scheduled from Wednesday, August 22nd to Sunday, August 26th are canceled. On Hawaii Island, all schools and the University of Hawaii campuses are closed until further notice. All beach parks from South Point north to Kohala are closed until further notice. All pavilion camping permits for these parks have been canceled. South Point Road from Kama'oa Road Junction to South Point, all closed to all traffic. And all county offices and facilities are operational, including transfer stations and landfills. Moving on to Maui, Red Cross shelters will be open to the general public at 2 p.m. today. Visit redcross.org or see Maui County's Facebook and Twitter pages for a full list of shelter locations. Hawaii Material Recycling in Kehi is offering aggregate for filling sandbags, so take advantage of that if you need it. It is free for personal use. Call Brent Dell at 808-495-2141. And here on Oahu, city officials are asking residents to reduce water usage to just essential needs. Here is Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell.
The Board of Water Supply is asking residents to only do essential watering. Do not go out and irrigate your lawn at this point, or wash your car, or fill your swimming pool, or anything else, because Water Supply wants to make sure that every single reservoir and every single tank on this island is filled to capacity. Because if we lose electricity, even though they have generators, it's going to take longer, and they want to make sure that there's water in these tanks so they don't have to pump water into it.
So residents of all counties can sign up for mobile alerts from their respective local authorities. Oahu residents should download the free HNL Info smartphone app. Maui residents visit the Maui Emergency Management Agency website to register for the Maka'ala alert system. Hawaii Island residents can sign up for free text message alerts from County Civil Defense at hawaii.gov. And Kauai County residents can sign up for free voice and text alerts from the Kauai Emergency Management Agency using the Blackboard Connect portal. Look for the large orange button on the Kauai Emergency Management Agency page at kauai.gov. So that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll continue to track Hurricane Lane and we'll talk smart yields for farmers. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. How are you preparing for Hurricane Lane? Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.